The headlines this hour. Moscow and Kiev keep pounding targets in eastern Ukraine, despite Russian leaders ordering a ceasefire for the Orthodox Christmas. Yemenis fill the streets for the second day, demanding an end to the years-long Saudi siege of their country. And people in Peru hold nationwide rallies. They want President Dina Boluarte to resign.
Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mies. Thanks for joining us.
Russia says its troops are still observing the 36-hour ceasefire, despite artillery attacks by Ukraine's army.
The united group of Russian troops has been honoring the ceasefire along the entire line of contact in the area of the special military operation since 9 o'clock GMT on January the 6th. Meanwhile, the Kiev regime has continued to shell civilian areas and Russian positions with artillery over the past 24 hours.
The defense ministry spokesman added that Russian troops have returned fire from Ukrainian forces in self-defense. Ukrainian officials claim that Russian forces keep carrying out strikes against some cities in the country. The brief ceasefire that began on Friday ends at Saturday midnight. The truce was called by President Putin, aimed at halting fighting during the Orthodox Christmas, which both countries observe. Ukraine's President Zelensky has rejected the truce as a ploy by Russia to bolster its army's defenses. Moscow has repeatedly said it is open to negotiations to end the conflict, while Ukraine says Russia must withdraw its forces first. A strike by UK railway workers has entered its fifth and final day, with thousands of signalers and train crew walking out. Only about one in five trains across the country is running on Saturday. Passengers have already been advised to avoid taking trains. Union leaders are due to meet the rail minister on Monday to resolve a dispute over pay. Workers want better pay and working conditions at the time when inflation has soared to record levels in the UK. The action is the latest in strikes in the past months over the same issue, involving different sectors, from nurses to teachers. The government is now planning to introduce a new law that would make it harder for key workers to strike. The legislation forces them to maintain a basic level of service during strike time or face dismissal. Our correspondent in London, Rob Carter, joined us earlier to discuss the British government's stance on the demands of the unions.
The government, of course, is not backing down in terms of seemingly giving in to many or any of their demands, which is essentially they want higher pay, better pay standards, that kind of thing, to defeat inflation and so on. But basically, the government is now introducing this new measure, these new laws, which again is putting them in a very awkward position where they're essentially taking away rights of unions to strike and their workers to strike. And this, of course, is something which brings into question the nature of Britain's democracy right now. The government is saying, however, that they have to make a choice here because they can't afford to increase everyone's pay and they have to keep important services like the ambulance, nurses at work in order to stop unnecessary loss of life. But again, this is not being well received by members of the public and also by union bosses themselves, who have been completely condemning the government outright as basically acting in a kind of dictatorial fashion, or taking the country in a way that would resemble more of a dictatorship, which perhaps one day will ultimately ban unions and workers' ability to strike. That's the kind of thing that's being speculated now. And that's the direction, the slippery slope that Britain finds itself in. But the opposition Labour Party have decided that they will fight against this, even though Labour themselves have also been condemned for compromising on their traditional values of standing up for workers' rights. Here it seems that the government has gone too far and Labour has decided they'll take a stand.
People have flocked to the streets in Yemen demanding an end to the Saudi-led coalition's blockade on their country. It was the second day of rallies against the blockade in place by Saudi Arabia and its allies for 8 years now. Demonstrators are strongly critical of the international community for its inaction to bring an end to the Saudi war and siege. The conflict has devastated Yemen, where the majority of the population relies on humanitarian aid, and the existing blockade makes it difficult for the Yemenis to have access to basic supplies. The Yemeni demonstrators have called for decisive military action against Saudi Arabia and the UAE to force them to end the siege.
This rally has been staged in the Yemeni capital along with several other Yemeni provinces called Al-Hisar Harb Alayna, which translates to "the siege is war upon us." Yemen is experiencing one of the worst humanitarian crises in history due to what protesters call the U.S. and Saudi Arabia strangling blockade on innocent civilians. Demonstrators called for an immediate end to the blockade and the ongoing war.
العظيمة المباركة.
We came out in this blessed protest to tell the aggressors and their allies that their blockade is a war on us. Therefore, we, the Yemeni people, say if you do not lift your blockade, we will certainly teach you a lesson you will never forget. We will not sit back and watch our people starve to death.
We came out to deliver a message to the world that we will no longer remain silent on this aggression, war, and blockade on our people.
Yemen's military spokesperson reiterated this week that if the Saudi-led coalition fails to lift the blockade, the Yemeni army will have no choice but to use military force to break the siege. Protesters in Sana'a expressed that it's time to use the military card, since the Saudi-led coalition continues to seize Yemeni fuel ships in the Red Sea. The protest comes after a week of violence stemming from the continuous Saudi shelling in the northern province of Sa'da, which has killed and injured dozens of civilians over the past 2 weeks. Furthermore, Saudi Arabia continues to seize and detain Yemeni fuel ships in the Red Sea, preventing them from reaching the port of Hodeidah and unloading the much-needed fuel supply. The Saudi-led coalition attacked Yemen in 2015, declaring they would defeat the Ansar Allah movement and their allies within a matter of weeks. It is now 2023, and they have not achieved any of their goals. This, as the Yemeni government based in Sana'a continues to advance its military deterrence capabilities. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
The recent visit by the UAE's foreign minister has sparked anger among U.S. officials and has rekindled their bullying tactics. They're telling the UAE that any attempt to normalize ties with the Assad government will prove costly. The UAE is not taking kindly to the threats.
Sheikh Abdulaziz bin Zayed's recent trip to Damascus was the second time he met with the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad as the two Arab nations continued to warm up to each other. The two top diplomats discussed restoration of relations and boosting of economic ties, with Assad saying that they will help regional stability and Sheikh Abdullah expressing support for a diplomatic solution to the conflict in Syria, as he was joined by a group of economic and security officials on his visit. Relations between Syria and the UAE were severed after Syria was expelled from the 22-member Arab League all the way back in 2011. The UAE reopened its embassy in Syria in 2018. Bahrain, Algeria, and Jordan have also resumed ties with Syria, while other Arab nations are calling for Syria's reinstation to the Arab League. This trend has not been sitting well with the U.S., as officials have slammed the visit by Sheikh Abdullah. One U.S. senator has even threatened the UAE with sanctions in a tweet in typical Twitter fashion. UAE's outreach to the Assad regime provides little benefits to the Emirates. This carries huge risks to UAE's reputation, exposes it to Caesar sanctions, and hurts efforts to seek accountability for Assad's crimes against the Syrian people. The Caesar sanctions refers to the Caesar Syria Civilian Protection Act of 2019, also known as the Caesar Act. It is a U.S. legislation that not only sanctions the Syrian government, but also any entity, organization, or individual that provides funding or assistance to it. Iranian and Russian entities have been sanctioned under this act. It follows a pattern in U.S.'s attitude towards its foreign relations. If they don't want to conduct business with a country, no other country should be allowed to either. Sheikh Abdulaziz had criticized the Caesar Act back in 2021 during a meeting with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov. He said, "Bigger challenge today facing coordination and working with Syria is the Caesar Act," and further added, "To keep the Caesar Act as it is today makes this path very difficult, not only for us as a nation, but also for the private sector." To those comments, the U.S. replied that it would not ease up on its stances towards Syria, a stance they have maintained to this day, as apparent by their latest remarks surrounding the latest meeting between Turkish and Syrian officials.
Syrian and Turkish defense ministers have held talks for the first time since the year 2011. This has prompted the U.S. Department of State to reiterate opposition to any kind of normalization of ties with the Syrian government.
In the first time that Ankara and Damascus held talks among their high-ranking officials since 2012, defense ministers of both countries met in Moscow at the end of December.
In that meeting, Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu said that he expects to meet with his Syrian and Russian counterpart later this month. This is a significant shift in Turkey's attitude towards Syria, as Ankara severed ties with the Arab nation back in 2012. And this shift has been met with a swift response from the U.S. When asked about the issue by reporters, Department of State spokesman Ned Price said, "We've made very clear to all of our allies and partners that now is not the time to normalize relations. Now is not the time to upgrade relations. Instead, in the eyes of the U.S., now is the time to impose further crippling sanctions on Syria, where the humanitarian conditions are deteriorating day by day, as the sanctions also include medicinal supplies." A UN special rapporteur on the negative impacts of unilateral coercive measures visited Syria and said that the sanctions have had catastrophic effects on the lives of Syrians as the country grapples with food and medicine shortages. She also said, "In the current dramatic and still deteriorating humanitarian situation, as 12 million Syrians grapple with food insecurity, I urge the immediate lifting of all unilateral sanctions that severely harm human rights and prevent any efforts for early recovery, rebuilding, and reconstruction." Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said on Thursday that he may meet his Syrian counterpart as part of a new peace process in the wake of the country's defense minister's meeting. An Erdogan-Assad meeting will signal the official failure of U.S. attempts to topple the Syrian government through sanctions and boycotts, as it will show that U.S. allies are no longer listening to the will of America. It will cause embarrassment for the U.S., not quite on the level of their exodus in Afghanistan, but not too far off either.
The U.S. has imposed fresh sanctions on Iran, this time targeting suppliers of drones that Washington claims Russia has been using in the war in Ukraine. Sanctions targeted six executives and board members of Quds Aviation Industries. The U.S. Treasury Department described the industries as a key Iranian defense manufacturer, responsible for designing and producing drones. The sanctions also targeted the director of Iran's Aerospace Industries Organization. The measures freeze any U.S.-based assets of those targeted individuals and bans Americans from dealing with them. Iran has denied allegations that it has provided Russia with drones to be used in the war in Ukraine. Tehran says it did send drones to Russia, but that was before the start of the war in February. Moscow has also denied using Iranian drones in Ukraine. Iran has hosted a conference on slain Iranian commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. He was assassinated in a U.S. air raid in Iraq in 2020. Yusuf Jalali has more.
3 years have passed since the U.S. assassination of top Iranian military commander General Qasem Soleimani. Dozens of commemoration ceremonies have been held across Iran. Senior military and state officials attended this gathering in Tehran to pay their respect to General Soleimani.
Martyr Soleimani was the forerunner of all the martyrs who lost their lives in the fight against terrorism. That's why his name continues to be remembered by Iranians.
Not only did the American authorities committed this crime, but they openly took responsibility for it. We have been following up on our legal pursuit with the cooperation of Iraq's judiciary to bring the perpetrators to justice.
Soleimani was the commander of a branch of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps called the Quds Force, which is in charge of conducting overseas operations. He was killed on January 3, 2020, in a drone strike outside Baghdad International Airport on a direct order from then-U.S. President Donald Trump. Millions took part in his funeral, both in Iraq and Iran. Now, on his third assassination anniversary, Iranians still feel the loss.
It's been 3 years now that we lost our commander. We call him the Commander of Hearts because he fought Daesh overseas to keep the terrorists at bay and prevent them from entering our soil. We owe our security to General Soleimani.
General Soleimani is known for his role in eliminating Daesh terrorists in Iraq in 2017. He also led major operations in Syria that led to the recapturing of key areas from Daesh. That's why his assassination is viewed as a huge loss for the region and a big win for the terrorists.
People here say General Soleimani's assassination gave a clear clue about who is who in the fight against terrorism in the region. They say the U.S. killed the nemesis of Daesh, and that corroborates Trump's claim that America created Daesh. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Peruvians have hit the streets again, demanding the resignation of President Dina Boluarte, took over from her ousted predecessor Pedro Castillo in December. Protesters blocked roads, threw stones and burned tires in several cities. In some places, police fired tear gas to disperse the crowd that was trying to barricade the main routes. Peru has been in a turmoil ever since Castillo was removed from office and arrested for attempting to dissolve Congress to avoid an impeachment. He is now in pretrial detention over charges of rebellion and conspiracy. The former Vice President Boluarte assumed power shortly after Castillo's removal. She has already rescheduled general elections to minimize public anger. Almost two dozen people have been killed in protests since last month. The race is just over. The U.S. House of Representatives finally elects a new speaker after 15 rounds of voting this week. Kevin McCarthy from California won the post after defeats over 4 days caused by Republican infighting. A group of 20 hardline Republicans were against McCarthy. They had cited a lack of trust on him over political issues with President Joe Biden and the Democratic-held Senate. McCarthy gave concessions to be able to get the post. He's succeeding Democrat Nancy Pelosi. Republicans took control of the U.S. House in November elections. The latest race to name a new speaker was the longest in 160 years. Biden has congratulated McCarthy, says that he is ready to work with Republicans. The latest saga at the U.S. House was overshadowed by the third anniversary of the January 6th storming of the Capitol by the supporters of the former President Donald Trump.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Majority of U.S. Republicans are against the candidacy of former President Donald Trump in the presidential elections in 2024. Donald Trump is the only president in the history of the United States who has been impeached twice on charges of abuse of power, obstruction of law, and inciting supporters to attack Congress on 6th of January 2021. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. CNN has covered the story and tells us more. Republican Governor Asa Hutchinson of Arkansas says former U.S. President Donald Trump should never be allowed to run for public office again over inciting the deadly violence on 6th of January 2021. Asa Hutchinson, who is considered running for president, reiterated on Sunday, 1st of January, that he preferred a different GOP presidential candidate in 2024, who was not Donald Trump. Hutchinson, a 72-year-old, leaves office in January after serving 8 years as Arkansas's governor. Asa Hutchinson said, "I do not believe that Donald Trump should be the next president of the United States. I think he's had his opportunity there. I think 6th of January really disqualified him for the future. The Arkansas governor said he'd do everything in his power to make sure that there is an alternative Republican nominee for the 2024 presidential race. Asa Hutchinson added, "I want to see everything I can do to make sure there is the alternative and that Donald Trump is not the nominee of the Republican Party. That's the first thing, and let's figure out how to do that." The U.S. House Select Committee lawmakers probing the assault on the Capitol Hill on 6th of January 2021 concluded in their final report, released on 22nd of December, that Donald Trump was to blame for the deadly incident and also charged him with orchestrating the riot in a failed attempt to cling onto power after losing the 2020 election. The report asserted in its executive summary, "The central cause of 6th of January was one man, former President Donald Trump, who many others followed, placing the mob invasion of the Capitol within a multiple-part plan to overturn the 2020 presidential election." The 845-page report, produced after months of witness testimony heard by the bipartisan 9-member panel, said, "President Trump or his inner circle engaged in at least 200 apparent acts of public or private outreach, pressure, or condemnation, targeting either state legislatures or state or local election administrators, or overturn state election results in the 2 months between the election and the Capitol riots." The committee also made a series of 11 recommendations for actions that Congress should take to prevent efforts similar to those to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election from happening again. It also made referrals for the Justice Department to pursue 4 criminal charges against Donald Trump. Trump said the American people have been deceived with lies about the 6th of January 2021 attack from the House Select Committee investigating the incident. He said the House committee cut the part of his speech at the rally at the Ellipse preceding the unrest, out in which he said demonstrators will be walking to the Capitol peacefully and patriotically. But he also said in his speech that people must show strength to take back our country and called on people to fight like hell. The U.S. newspaper The New York Times has also covered the same story. The release of the full report was the culmination of the panel's 18-month inquiry and came 3 days after the committee voted to formally charge Donald Trump with inciting insurrection, conspiracy to defraud the United States, obstruction of an act of Congress, and one other federal crime, as it referred him to the Justice Department for potential prosecution. While the referrals do not compel federal prosecutors to take any action, they sent a powerful signal that a select committee of Congress believes the former president had committed crimes. Representative Liz Cheney, Republican of Wyoming and the vice chairwoman of the committee, wrote in the report, "Our institutions are only strong when those who hold office are faithful to our Constitution. Part of the tragedy of 6th of January 2021 is the conduct of those who knew that what happened was profoundly wrong, but nevertheless tried to downplay it, to minimize it, or to defend those responsible." The report contains the committee's legislative recommendations, which are intended to prevent future presidents from attempting a similar plot. The panel has already endorsed overhauling the Electoral Count Act, the law that Donald Trump and his allies tried to exploit on 6th of January 2021 in an attempt to cling on to power. Among the committee's recommendations were a possible overhaul of the Insurrection Act and strengthening of the enforcement of the 14th Amendment's ban on insurrections holding office. The panel also said Congress should consider legislation to bolster its subpoena power and increase penalties against those who threaten election workers. And it said bar associations should consider whether any of the lawyers who aided Donald Trump's attempts to overturn the election should be punished. In addition to its focus on Donald Trump's actions, the report went into great detail about the supporting cast of lieutenants who enabled him. Mark Meadows, his final chief of staff, and the lawyers John Eastman, Rudolph Giuliani, Jeffrey Clark, and Kenneth Chesbrough were named as potential co-conspirators in Donald Trump's various attempts to cling on to power. Trump bashed the report on his social media site, Truth Social, calling it highly partisan. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. The Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger said in an interview on Sunday, 1st of January, that he believes the Department of Justice will do the right thing and bring criminal charges against Donald Trump for his role in the attack on the U.S. Capitol and on 6th of January 2021. Adam Kinzinger told CNN's State of the Union political talk show on Sunday morning, 1st of January, he said, "I think he will be charged, and I frankly think he should be charged." Adam Kinzinger was one of two Republicans on the democratically led January 6 Select Committee, which wrapped up its investigation before the new Congress began its work, when Republicans assumed the majority in the House followed last November's midterm elections. Adam Kinzinger led one of the committee's sessions last June that focused on pressure placed on the Justice Department by Donald Trump or his allies as he strove to persuade them to overturn his 2020 defeat by falsely claiming the election was blighted by widespread fraud. He has represented Illinois in the House of Representatives since 2011 and was speaking following the last sessions held by the committee and on the eve of his departure from Congress. Adam Kinzinger also slammed Republican leaders for maintaining Donald Trump's influence on the U.S.'s political landscape by playing down the significance of the Capitol attack and Donald Trump's incitement of the riot, and often backing Trump's lies about elections being rigged or stolen in favor of Democrats. He blamed the House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who is currently battling to become the new Speaker of the House, as the reason for the former president remaining such a force in U.S. politics. Adam Kinzinger said, "He's the reason Donald Trump is still a factor. He is the reason that some of the crazy elements of the House still exist." Kinzinger said McCarthy had visited Trump at his Mar-a-Lago, Florida residence shortly after the January 6 insurrection. "That show of mutual support at a pivotal moment resurrected Trump's relevance in U.S. politics, strengthening the right." Adam Kinzinger added, "Donald Trump should consider Kevin McCarthy his best friend, because Donald Trump is alive today politically because of Kevin McCarthy." He noted that the then Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and other Senate Republicans failed to convict Donald Trump during his historic second impeachment trial for inciting an insurrection.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Calabas Lampage. We're welcome to another episode of the program Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi and Shaykh Rouhani are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom for today's discussion. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about a part of history in which Reza Khan, the then king of Iran, tried to unveil the women, in fact, to remove the Islamic hijab from the body and the head of the women, the scarves of the women, unveil them, and somehow bring a kind of new westernized lifestyle into Iran on that time. Was he successful or not? Said Mohsen, let's start with you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, obviously, he was definitely unsuccessful. And the reason is that when we look at the psychology of a society, mm-hmm. or when we want to know about a society, every society has some beliefs.
Yes.
And especially when we talk about the Iranian society, if you look at the Iranian society, we see that the Iran from last 5,000 years, you know, the people of Iran is living in the same area. They're not from the immigrants. They did not migrate to have the rulership. Whereas, for example, you know, the Turkish, they were somehow moved to the different places. They yes. migrated in order to have, you know, their, we can say, like, rulership and all those. But when we look at the Iranian history from, like, Hakamanashi, like they say, like that
yes.
time
yes.
onwards.
Comedians. Yes.
From that time onwards, yes. we see that the Iran has its own emperorship.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously it has its own traditions, which is rooted into the Iranian nation, we can say. Like hijab, when we talk about the hijab, yes, one of the perspective of hijab is the Islamic view of that.
Yes.
But even before Islam, they had a proper clothing.
Yes.
You know, it's in the tradition. Like if you talk about, if you talk to the people who are living in different, like far places in
yes.
Iran, when you talk about the culture, culturally they were having the veil.
Yes.
It was culturally rooted.
Yes.
So what Reza Khan was trying to do with the backup of France, mm-hmm. basically,
yes.
what they wanted to do is they wanted to change the mentality of people.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to force people to unveil themselves, especially the women, so that they can have this Western secular culture within the Iranian culture.
A lifestyle, yes.
The lifestyle.
Yes.
Whereas the Iranian people are full of Iranian culture.
Yes.
And it's impossible for anyone to do
so
that.
So you want to say that beside Islamic culture, Iranians
yes.
there have chastity, okay? Even
chastity and
yes,
all these things
yes,
are rooted in the Iranian
yes, yes.
nation.
It is very much interesting that even Salman Muhammadi, Salman al-Farsi,
yes.
has told Prophet Muhammad about the way of the clothing and dress code of the Persians. And it had direct role on the hijab of the women of Arab Peninsula on that time, okay?
Yes.
The women that were living on that time. Even in the stones and in the documents that exist today from the pictures of the old Persia, you could see that the women are covered from top to toe. And this is really fascinating. But because of a trip of Reza Khan to the Turkey and seeing Ataturk, you know, changing all the lifestyle of the people, he has decided to change the lifestyle. Unfortunately, Qiyam-e Goharshad, the massacre of Goharshad took place, and the other cases. Okay, Sheikh Rouhani, let's start with you, brother. How do you look at the Reza Khan's efforts to unveil the women, and he was not successful?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, of course, as our respected guest says, that he was not successful, definitely. You know, there are many reasons that why Reza Khan was not successful in this regard. First of all, we should understand that hijab or observing hijab is an Islamic rule or ruling that it has its, let's say, roots in a very, let's say, ancient or historical kind of tradition and culture. And a kind of social values that we've had throughout the history in this area, in this
yes.
region. So it has its own, let's say, strong and powerful principles based on which the Islamic laws and Islamic legal system and rulings are based by these scholars. This is the first point.
Yes.
It is not something that could be changed during, for example, one day or in one night. It's impossible.
Yes.
The other point is that, unfortunately, at that time, the King Reza Khan and Ataturk and Amanullah Khan and the three countries, Islamic countries like Afghanistan, Iran, and Turkey, they were actually supported by this modern or, let's say, secular kind of regimes in Europe,
yes,
they wanted to forcefully change the culture and the traditions of the society, Islamic society. It is completely wrong to dictate the people how they live, how, for example, they, let's say, take their lifestyle. It is totally wrong because other kings, other, let's say, invaders, attackers in the history, they were not also successful in this regard. So that's why when you dictate the people from outside how to observe, for example, your lifestyle, that is totally wrong. It will never succeed, not only in Iran and any other areas as well. So that's why it was a mistake, because at that time it is said that once one of the Maharaja at that time issued a fatwa against tobacco. That's very much famous.
Mirza Shirazi. Tobacco movement,
Yeah, of course.
Ban of tobacco.
You see that the women and the daughters and the family members of Reza Khan followed this fatwa.
Yes.
And let's say accepted this fatwa and they followed the Maraji Taqlids. You see that it was Maraji who ruled.
Of course, that was for the time of Nasiruddin Shah.
Nasiruddin Shah, So
Before Reza Khan.
Before Pahlavi. That's why we see that even at the time of Reza Khan, it was the Maraji. Like Ayatollah Burujerdi,
Ayatollah Khansari, Ayatollah Sayyid Hussein Khomi, as known as Agha Tabatabai, Sayyid Abu Qasim Kashani. And that's why when Muhammad Reza, the son of Reza Khan, comes to the power, he abrogates Qanune, because unveiling the women, the law, because of the presence of Maraja.
It was Maraja, it was ulama and scholars who governed the people actually in reality, not the kings, not the, let's say, the presidents at that time.
That's right.
The other point is that nowadays you see in Turkey, the people wanted to make hijab something legal. There are a group of people in Turkey. While the case was vice versa in Turkey, because Ataturk actually tried to unveil hijab to leave aside these kind of Islamic rulings. But nowadays, after these many decades, now the women, now the people of Turkey came to this conclusion that no, that was the correct way, the true way to observe hijab. I mean that this observing hijab is something coincide with the nature of the women. Yeah,
of the women.
As you rightly mentioned, chastity, dignity, or something that every woman wants that. And that is why when you help and support women to be more dignified, that's why they will welcome it, of course, if they would understand correctly and truly that hijab is something for the benefit of them, not the others. It's a kind of the way of protection, way of saving guard them against the strangers, against the bad people, not to be misused or abused. This is the way that the Muslim women observe hijab. This is the reason, actually.
There is also another famous figure, Ayatollah Muhammad Taghi Bafqi Yazdi, who Reza Khan came into the holy shrine of Lady Fatima al-Mahziba with his women without hijab. And that's why that Ayatollah Bafqi, raised his voice, and he was sent into prison and exile. Even he was, beaten hard by Reza Khan. That why do you say this is the holiest place in the world? How do you dare to enter the women into this place without hijab, you yourself? You know, and the strong position of the, as you said, Maharaja on that time, and even the women, because there were so many women on that time with hijab, so they stopped sending the girls to the schools. The schools were shut down because of this, and so many public, I mean, among the ordinary people, has also raised against this position. Okay, Sayyid? Your final remarks.
Well, obviously, there is a philosophy behind this, why these things has not happened. And it cannot happen in any country.
Okay.
I'm not just talking about the hijab right now.
Yes.
I'm talking about the roots of something when a change comes. For example, nowadays we're talking about the Islamic banking. Some of the people or economists, they're thinking of applying Islamic banking into the Western countries.
Yes.
For example. Or maybe the Western banking system into the Islamic countries. This is not possible. Why? Because, for example, if you are talking about the Islamic banking, it can only be applied in the Islamic society.
Yes.
And not in non-Islamic society. Similarly, the Western banking system that we have. Why today in the Muslim countries people are talking against it? why people are talking about no interest, you know, banking system. Yes. It's because they are living in a Muslim society where the system, banking system, is non-Muslim. Yes. So anything which is not in line with the teachings of their religion in a society, it cannot be applied in any case.
Yes.
Either it's about the veiling. You know, if you want to unveil the women in any country,
yes,
for example, Iran, Pakistan, or anything, you need to make them non-Muslim first. If they leave their religion, yes, they will unveil themselves.
Okay, then they are not allowed to leave. But,
yeah. So that's the case. Okay. That's the case. Similarly, if we want the Western people, like an atheist, living in America, in Europe, I don't know, Christian or Jewish, wearing the veil or hijab, if they don't have that in their teachings, if they don't have that in their religion, they will never follow you.
Yes.
Either if you say, like, these are the benefits and you look more prettier, I don't know, it's the modesty and all those.
Okay.
You bring all these reasons.
Yes.
Because this is not something which is in their society. It's not in their beliefs. That's why you cannot, even with the politeness or force, by forcing them, you can make them to have the hijab. So one of the main reasons of Raza Khan and the today's, you know, this woman, I don't know, freedom and the things that are going on in Iran.
I think the main
slogan
is, that's right, Zan Zendegi Azadi, the woman, we can say
life
and freedom.
Yes. Freedom.
Okay.
Why, like, they say, like, there's a force veiling, the force of, you know, having hijab. Why this movement is failing in Iran, like, they want to unveil everyone, they're burning their scarves. It's because the people of Iran are the Muslims, and especially Shia Muslims, who follow Hazrat Fatima Zahra salamu alayha, who follow the Hazrat Zainab salamu alayha, Lady Zainab.
Yes.
So such people will never listen to you.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you say, like, in media, whatever, you talk about this. Why? Because people are, the roots of the people are in Islam. They are rooted, the beliefs in Islam. And the most important thing is that this area, in its culture, these things are rooted.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot take culture of someone away. So that's
the religious culture, that's right. Sometimes I think sometimes the people want to be more Catholic than Pope himself.
Yeah.
You know, you want to be looked like a Western woman, you know, in the Western country, regardless of the fact that even in the Western world, if you look at it, for example, 50 years ago, the chastity and the dress code and the coverings were more and more. And this is really a problem of the 21st century, that how the people are invited and encouraged to be nude, to be naked.
Yeah,
and nudity, according to the official statistics in the Western world, is the main cause for sexual assault, sexual abuse, underage raping, underage sexual activities, unwanted pregnancy, abortion, and all of that, okay? These are all the problems that are mainly rooted in nudity and sex appeal that is unfortunately advertised by the Western powers. And Sheikh, your final remarks, sorry.
Yeah, the very reason by which Imam Khomeini succeeded, that is the reason that why Reza Khan did not succeed.
Uh-huh.
You know, because the women of Iran supported Imam Khomeini, rahmatullahi alayhi.
Yes.
And this was the reason that tells us that Imam Khomeini's idea, slogans, let's say, beliefs, were totally and comprehensively in line with the hearts of Iranian women.
Yes.
That's why they supported Imam Khomeini and they did not support Reza Khan.
Yes.
This was the reason that Reza Khan did not succeed.
Yes. So many of the religious communities on that time did not went to the movies because nude pictures were shown on the movies, you know, and the women were not satisfied exactly by what they had as a woman in their status. You know, the status of the woman was degraded, and because of imitating the Western lifestyle, the Iranian woman, who was respected because of her hijab, because of her covering the body, was now changed into a sex tool for the men and a tool of enjoyment. And we can't say, as you said, the late Imam Khomeini stopped all of this. Okay, that's right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Rouhani and Sayyid Mohsen, for a nice elaboration regarding the concept of why Reza Khan was not successful in unveiling the women of Iran. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
know that you could easily take away everything you've given me. And I try to remember not to take anything for granted.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. Please don't forget to log on to our website at parsetoday.ir. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah. Ya Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you by my side. I wish to be to you throughout my life, ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me all the way.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parsetoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
British retail consortium figures come amid concern over economy and rising cost of energy bills. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Guardian reported UK food price rises soared to a record rate in December 2022. Figures show as retail industry bosses warned that high inflation would continue in 2023 amid the fallout from surging energy bills. Annual food inflation jumped to 13.3% in December 2022, up from 12.4% in November, according to the latest monthly report from trade body, the British Retail Consortium, BRC, and the data from Nielsen. The BRC said this was the highest monthly rate since it began collecting data in 2005. Highlighting the presence on households during the festive shopping season, the industry snapshot showed the price of many essential foods rose sharply as the reverberations from the Russia-Ukraine crisis continued to drive up energy costs. The BRC said high prices for animal feed, fertilizer and energy fed into higher food prices on supermarket shelves, while warning that consumers would probably face further increases in 2023. It was a challenging Christmas for many households across the UK, said the BRC's chief executive, Helen Dickinson, adding, 2023 will be another difficult year for consumers and businesses as inflation shows no immediate signs of waning. The figures came as concerns grew about the strength of the British economy, with the headline inflation rates at its highest level since the early 1980s, driven by soaring gas and electricity bills. Manufacturers suffered a further downturn in activity in December 2022, with production, new orders and employment all in decline. The S&P Global SIPS UK Manufacturing Purchasing Managers Index fell to a 31-month low of 45.3 in December 2022, down from 46.5 in November 2022, indicating a fifth successive month of contraction in UK factory output. Domestic and overseas demand remained lackluster as the industry suffered a weak end to 2022, with companies facing rising costs, increasing market volatility and problems related to Brexit for firms with EU-based customers. John Glenn, the chief economist at the Chartered Institute of Procurement and Supply, said new orders dropped at one of the fastest rates in over a decade as overseas customers were put off by Brexit custom requirements, pushing up costs and delays, and domestic orders were affected by the general pressure from rising prices. As the soaring costs fed through to consumers, households sharply cut back on spending in recent months. Figures from Barclays show retail sales fell overseas in 2022, while high street footfall slumped last week at a time when consumers would usually be hitting the shops for the Boxing Day sales. According to the BRC figures for December 2022, when households usually stock up on Christmas food and other things, the inflation rate for fresh produce accelerated to a new record of 15% in December, up from 14.3% a month earlier. However, retailers offering steep discounts on non-food products helped to bring December's overall shop price inflation figure down a little to 7.3% from 7.4% the month before, as high street stores and online retailers looked to shed excess stock built up during periods of disruption to supply chains earlier in 2022. Aldi said it had experienced record Christmas sale as more shoppers tend to the discount chain amid the cost of living crisis. The retailer said sales jumped by 26% in December to top £1.4 billion in the UK and Ireland for the first time. The discounter highlighted strong sales of fresh meat products, with poultry 28% for the month. Chilled dessert sales rose by 30%, while sales of cheese increased by about 50%. Snacks such as crisps and nuts were up more than 40% as the World Cup coincided with the Christmas period for the first time. Dickinson said businesses struggling with soaring energy costs urgently required support from the government. The Chancellor Jeremy Hunt confirmed in the run-up to Christmas that he was preparing an extension in financial support for businesses with high energy bills, which would be announced early in the new year. According to ABC, with expectations that about 710,000 households across the UK will struggle to pay for warm clothing, heating and food this winter, residents in Burnley have resorted to cutting back on electricity use as much as possible. The wage issue was cast into sharp relief this month when workers took industrial action almost every day across a range of sectors. The UK faced widespread disruptions as everyone from postal workers to nurses, security staff and airport employees walked off the job, demanding better pay rises and conditions. One of the big challenges we are facing in the UK at the moment, for example, is a strike action of workers not being happy with the pay that are being offered in the face of high inflation and taking industrial action. Mr. Zoranko said, it comes at a strange time in the UK's job market, with businesses struggling to recruit enough staff as a growing number of people leave the workforce altogether. Also, Mr. Ivan said, the post-pandemic labour market feels pretty weird overall. We've got the situation where we've got record vacancies, we've got employers hiring at record rates, but employment is still 300,000. Below pre-pandemic levels, where in most other advanced economies, it is above pre-pandemic levels. Mr. Evans has been following the UK's workforce exodus for months and says there are two main reasons why people are leaving. Mr. Evans says, we estimate that there is about 1 million fewer people in the labour market than if pre-pandemic trends had continued, and that's mostly driven by over 50s leaving the labour market and also people with long-term sickness. While more research is needed, Mr. Ivan said those leaving due to long-term sickness may in part be a lingering effect of the pandemic. Amid growing cases of long COVID and people suffering mental health conditions in the UK, Mr. Zoranko said, where we are now, the economic outlook is bleak. It's going to be a painful couple of years. For households, it's going to be a couple of years being squeezed by energy prices, followed by a couple of years being squeezed by interest rates, probably. Some pockets of the UK are likely to be harder hit than others, according to Father Alex, saying, I think there was a bit of a celebration that COVID-19 was all over this year, but the actual legacy of the pandemic in places of urban deprivation, such as Burnley, is that the impacts are massive.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.